Liveline on RTE Radio 1, sponsored by Harry Curry. Don't miss out on amazing end-of-sale savings on bedding, curtains and more. Available now in-store or at harrycurry.com.
Emma, good afternoon.
Good afternoon to you, and thanks for having me on. I suppose, Rain, everybody's story is unique, you know, and everybody's journey is different. But definitely binge drinking definitely can lead to full-blown alcoholism down the line. You know, it's not good for anyone. Mm-hmm. And, you know, and mental health obviously always goes hand in hand with alcoholism. You know, Wayne, it doesn't matter if he's famous, if we're poor. You know, we all have the same feelings. We all go through the same thing during our journeys. Mm-hmm. and through alcoholism. And I'm sure Wayne had moments of despair, like everybody does when they're in addiction. And, you know, we all think the same way. We mm-hmm. all feel the same way. And as I say, it doesn't matter if you're rich or poor. We all have the same feelings at the end of the day. And I'm glad that his wife stuck by him. You know, I know, you know, you get chances, you get so many chances or whatever. But, you know, when you're in addiction, you really need the help and support from family members to pull yourself through. It's not everybody will come out the other side. But, you know, I'll always stress, you know, everything can be worked out. Everybody can, there's a chance for everybody to get out of it and become a better person and mm-hmm. become somebody moving on with their life.
Emma, did you need that kind of help or someone to save you?
I did. 14 years ago, I got help for my alcoholism and I turned my life around. You know, with the help of my family, with the help of close people around me, because I had pushed everybody away, you know, and then people could have kept walking and just said, listen, you know, we're washing our hands or whatever. But they didn't. They stuck by me. I wanted to be better. I wanted to be a better person. I struggled with mental health issues. It was a struggle for me. And, you know, and since 14 years have passed, I've become so much better in my life. I give more to people. I try and help when I can. And just to sometimes take a step back and not be, oh, look at me now, whatever. I still am an alcoholic. I still have struggles in life, but my life is so much better than it was before.
That's good to hear, Emma. Was it hard to come to that realisation? And thank you so much for talking to us about this, because you do it so well. And I know it can't be easy to talk about things like this. Would you have regarded yourself as a binge drinker in the way he describes?
Not really. As I say, everybody's drinking is different. Not necessarily binge drinking, but at the end of the day, it's all related to alcoholism, and we all end up in the same place, you know. Like a glass of wine to me would have turned into two, three, four, where I was using alcohol as a crutch to lean on problems that had occurred in my life as a young kid and child. And for me, that was the crutch I needed at the time. But that was the crutch that was going to break me down and just nearly destroy my life. So at the end of the day, it wasn't a friend. It was an enemy. And I think sometimes you have to realise, you know, when you see your life falling apart and you don't want to live here anymore, you want to be off this earth, you know, that it's time that I want to live. I want to be here for my family. I want to be here for my kids. And it's time to do something about it. But it is hard, because I think once people admit that they're an alcoholic, I think sometimes it's game over. And once you say that and that's out there, well, then it's time for help.
What do you mean, game over?
It means that you can't hide anymore, that you've admitted that you're an alcoholic and it's out there now and everybody knows. But it's just like people were waiting for you to say it. You know, you might say, oh, I have a drink problem, whatever. But some people don't like that word alcoholic. And sometimes I don't like it myself. You know, but at the end of the day, I had to say it and I had to look at myself in the mirror, which I couldn't do for a long time, because I didn't like the person I'd become. I didn't like who I was. And I had to look at myself in the mirror and say to myself, Emma, you're an alcoholic and you need help. And that's exactly what I did. And I went for help.
Very good. Something that struck me about this story is Wayne Rooney talking about how he could drink for 2 days on end, and yet he could go back to soccer training, and yet he could score goals for Man United at the weekend as well. Do you think people use terms like binge drinking, or they talk about wine o'clock or enjoying it? Do you think they use different terms? And I don't want to take away from anyone's enjoyment of it, but to sometimes cover up that word you say they don't want to mention.
Well, I don't know how Wayne Rooney done that, because I was not in good health all the time. I mentally and physically. So, you know, obviously he was a functioning alcoholic, as they call some people. For me, I sometimes struggle to get out of bed. Yes, sometimes I think people kind of that would have a drink problem, and I'm not taking away from people who enjoy a drink and whatever, and I'm happy for those who can and enjoy that. And we're not, this is not a stigma around them at all. This is about people that have alcohol problems. And yes, some people, I think, with alcohol issues, you know, they'd laugh and say, oh, it's 1 o'clock or it's 7 o'clock somewhere else. So I think sometimes that kind of thing would take away from somebody that's in addiction that it's okay.
And you don't like that term.
Some people, if they think it's okay, that's fine. Mm-hmm. But I suppose when I was in addiction, I would have loved that term. But at the moment, no. And I know people are going to come on here now and start whatever, but that's just my opinion of it now.
Oh, and you're very entitled to your opinion, and listeners can have theirs as well if they want. 51551, we'd love to hear from them. But you feel it can be a slippery slope, Emma?
Definitely. You know, you start off and slowly as you get into your addiction with alcohol and it becomes your friend, it's definitely a slippery slope. I actually, during COVID, you know, you try to keep busy, you know, in your recovery. And I live out in Inchbofin, so it was quite hard because there was nothing to do and there was nowhere to go. So I started making bars of soap, and I think I made like 500 bars of soap. And I made them for Hope House in Foxford, who I actually owe my life to.
Well done.
Dolores and Attractor there were absolutely wonderful, and I ran through that door as quick as I could to get there. So I boxed up all the soap, and on the soap, I was like, what am I going to call the soap? So I called the soap Slippery Slope. Slippery Slope. So everybody came into Hope. Slippery Slope, yeah.
Slippery Slope soap.
Slope. Yes.
For Hope House.
So everybody that came into Hope House got a bar of soap on their pillow, and they were told where it came from and my story, and it encouraged them that, you know, there is life after alcoholism, and we can all live a great life and a happy life. But I know every day can be a struggle for some people, but there is a future for everybody in recovery.
Is that a good feeling, Emma, to know you're inspiring others?
I hope I do.
You do.
I still struggle with up and down days, not about drink, but just with life in general. I'm going through some health issues at the moment, but I'm seeing the positive side of it, and things will work out. I have to be positive every day. Mm-hmm. And, you know, without turning to alcohol or anything else, I just need to have that positivity, you know, in my head, and just a feeling of hope, a feeling of future. You know, I work in the healthcare, so I'm actually here at the moment looking after my dementia patient who's actually in bed at the moment. So I give back. I try and give a little back. I went back to college a couple of years ago. I got my healthcare certificate. I do segments for downtown Denver from Inishbofin. I had an article in the Irish Independent. I try to be as I motivate myself, and I try and get involved in certain things just for people to read my story. I'm in the middle of writing a book at the moment, which I hope that comes out next year. So,
Emma, you are an inspiration. You are an inspiration.
Thank you.
And I wish you well with the health struggles you mentioned. Can I ask you a little bit? Because when we talk about binge drinking, I have to consult what the the medics and the experts tell us as well, okay. Because the HSC tells us that low-risk alcohol guidelines mean that you shouldn't drink more than 11 standard drinks per week if you're a woman, or 17 yes. standard drinks if you're a man, and that you should spread your drinks across the week, having days without alcohol, of course, and to be aware yes. that a standard drink is a half a pint. So a pint would be with two standard drinks. And when we're talking about a glass of wine, it's a small glass mm-hmm. of wine if it's a standard drink as well. Would you have seen that where, you know, your glass of wine was getting bigger, or it was turning into a bottle, or it when you talk about the slippery slope?
Yeah.
I called it soap. Go on.
Yeah, sorry. Yes, you start off with your glass of wine, and then you know, slowly you make it bigger, and one bottle turns into two bottles, and by the end of the week you could be up to 10 bottles of wine. Like, so yes, it does, and it does affect your health. You know, I mean I had heart problems where I ended up in intensive care in Castlebar with near heart failure from my drinking, and the alcoholism disease is so strong that even though I nearly died, I still continued to harm myself and get sicker and sicker mentally and physically and everything else. And I didn't care, because the disease is so powerful. You actually don't care about anything else, only your drink and how it makes you feel, you know. So it is harmful, and it can affect you. Mm-hmm. As I say, I wouldn't binge drink, but I know binge drinking for some people could be down in 6 pints in like half an hour or whatever. Like, and I mean, that's dangerous for, you know, for mental health as well, for heart disease, for you can get alcohol poisoning. You can end up seriously ill from it. I'm not an expert, so I don't really mm-hmm. know.
You're making complete sense, though, Emma. The HSC says it is not safe to drink your weekly limit in one session mm-hmm. over a couple of nights. This is what they call binge drinking, and they say binge drinking causes most harm to your health. You may lose control, have accidents, and take risks. But when you say that you kept on harming yourself by mm-hmm. drinking, even after what sounds like a life-threatening medical scare, it's because of what you're saying, I think, Emma, it's just that obviously at the time you were doing that to maybe avoid facing the issue, facing the problem. How, when you finally confront that problem, when you finally realised it, how did that feel?
Well, I suppose I didn't really start drinking heavily till I was in my 30s, and I had a lot on in younger years. I ended up living out in Inishbofin since I was 16 and a half on my own. I kind of came back from a dysfunctional family as well, with mm-hmm. their problems as well. So I ended up finding myself on my own, which I love my own company now to this day, but, you know, I ended up on my own here. And it was difficult because I didn't have any money and I didn't have a place to stay. And eventually I got a couple of jobs, and I ended up, you know, making this place my home. And I ended up here, and then I ended up having family at a young age, and obviously my marriage didn't work out, and all that kind of stuff. But I wasn't drinking then. I think it was when my kids reached a certain age and I ended up like in my early 30s that I was abused, sexually abused as a child. And I suppose for years, you know, you blame yourself. Mm-hmm. And all of a sudden I had time to think. And the more I thought about what happened to me as a child, the more I blamed myself and blamed myself for, you know, why me, why the way my family was, why was I on my own. I actually started feeling sorry for myself, which I shouldn't have, because none of it was my, you know, I had made a life for myself. But I think the abuse thing to me was the biggest part of my drinking.
And I'm really sorry.
And I can understand people. Yeah, and that's fine. And I can talk about it now, but, you know, I just want people out there, and most of the people that have been abused in some form are in addiction and suffer from mental health, you know?
And I am really sorry to hear about that, Emma. 51551, by the way, for listeners who want to get in touch about this, because we're talking about binge drinking and problems of alcoholism as well that Emma has explained to us so well too. You mentioned your kids and your family, and I'm wondering, did your drinking impact on them, Emma?
Yes, it did. My children nearly walked away from me, and I still continued to drink, even though I was pushing them away. And, oh, my God, like, I couldn't see it at the time because, like that, you talk about Wayne Rooney, he took risks. We all take risks, and that's what the disease does to you. You take risks, and you don't see the consequences of your actions until it's near an end. And luckily enough, my children stood by me, and to this day, I have an amazing relationship with my children. I love every single one of them dearly. I have four grandchildren who I absolutely adore. And if I didn't turn my life around, I don't think I would be speaking to you right now. And I wouldn't have anything, and life wouldn't be worth to live.
Mm-hmm. Well, you did, and well done, Emma, once again. And I hope that that feels good. And I do think you inspire others now. Are there bad days now, or how do you deal with it now? When because addiction like this is something you deal with for life.
Life struggles for everybody. There's nobody perfect in this world. You know, we all make mistakes. We all do stupid things. We all whatever. But you have to learn how to retrain your brain, basically, and you can do it to help yourself. And during lockdown, I was able to get on a meeting every Wednesday night, like with Brace, they used to be up in Ballymun, Gary and all the, and Brian there. And I used to talk to other people in addiction. And for me, it was so fantastic just to be able to talk about normal things that were going on for me. And I have, I'm not saying my life is perfect, no way, but I learned to deal with things in a different way, and I learned to park some stuff and then say, I'll go back to that, rather than when I was drinking, I'd run for a drink and say, that's how I'm going to sort that out. But now I have to sit and think, and I'll park it and I'll go back to it and I'll deal with it then. But life is so precious at the moment, you know, there's so many people struggling out there. And as I say, mental health goes with addiction. It goes hand in hand. And it's so important for everybody, you know, there's help out there if you really want it. And for people not to judge people and laugh at people and call them names. I mean, this is real. This is real life. Mm-hmm. And these are real people with real feelings, you know, at the end of the day.
Well said, Emma. Thank you very much. There is help out there. It's rte.ie/helplines if you've been affected by these issues. I'd love to know your story as well. 0818715815 51551 for your texts as well. Emma, you are an amazing person. Well done to you. And an amazing carer as well. You said you're caring for people with dementia as well. I take my hat off and salute carers at all times in my life and always will, because I know myself how great a difference they make in people's lives. Are you still making slippery slope soap?
No, I try and get involved in loads of things. So I, my friend comes from the States and she has like this badass women's tour. But badass isn't about women going off like getting drunk or like that. It's about women that have had issues in life that find it hard to cope. Might be a difficult situation, might be addiction, might be a divorce. Mm-hmm. So they come, she brings them to my house and we bake scones and we bake soda bread. And then we sit around a table and we drink tea and we talk. And I tell them my story and they open up and start to tell their story. So it's a bit of a kind of a relief for them. And they go back to America feeling a little bit better about themselves. So I do things like that to help people out. As I say, I have a segment in downtown Denver. Nice. I'm actually going out to Denver in 2 weeks' time. And I'm doing Denver Conversations podcast.
Very good.
So it's about my life and about my struggles and everything. So I have my hand in a few different things.
Emma, well done. Thanks very much. And here's to all the badass women out there.
Thank you to
all your amazing
and
stories.
Men, and men,
of course. And men, of course. We want to hear from you all. 0818715815. Liveline at rte.ie.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818715815.
There's lots of you reacting to Wayne Rooney being saved by binge drinking, from binge drinking by his wife, and to Emma's remarkably inspiring story there as well. Vivian, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John. How are you?
I'm very well. And how are you?
Thank you for having me on.
Oh, thanks for talking to us on Liveline today.
You.
Tell me, you were listening to Emma
Not
there.
At all. I was listening to Emma and I congratulate her. It needs to be spoken. She's correct. Everything that lady said is correct. Because, John, I was an alcoholic. Right. A functioning alcoholic.
Mm-hmm.
And not only that, but I also lost my son to alcoholism at 44 years of age.
Oh, I'm so sorry to hear that.
So it was very sad. And like that, that wine o'clock, she's correct in that wine o'clock, because my time was 7 o'clock. Every night was wine o'clock, and people would joke, you know, they'd say wine o'clock. Yeah. Oh, it's time for, like, if my family were visiting, the children, the grandchildren, once wine, once 7 o'clock came, I was up, and if they weren't going quick enough, I'd open my bottle of wine, and that was their cue to go.
Mm-hmm.
And I was just saying to your researcher there, producer, I drank, John, 14 bottles of wine a week. Every night.
Right.
So sometimes I'd go into a third bottle. And that was me. And I functioned on it. That's the worrying part of it. To the stage where, as I said there, I was told if I didn't stop, I'd be dead in 3 months.
And Vivian, you say it was 2 bottles of wine a night, going into a third sometimes.
Going into a third, I'd open a third and maybe have 2 glasses instead of a third.
Do you remember a time when it was just
from one?
That's what I was wondering.
Just one. It was, yes. It started maybe 2-3 glasses from one bottle.
Mm-hmm.
Then it went to a bottle, and then it went Do you know what I even did, John? I fooled myself. I didn't use a wine glass. I used to use a small whiskey glass. And I'd say to people, look, sure, I'm not drinking a glass of wine. You know, you see people when they fill or half fill a large glass of wine glass.
Mm-hmm.
Mine would be a little glass. So I was convincing myself, sure, there's no harm in that. Sure. 2 mouthfuls, it was gone.
Just having a small one, you told yourself.
I got to a stage where I was nearly drinking out of the bottle. That's how bad I got.
Mm-hmm.
And I could not function. I could not. I mean, as in, I was a functioning alcoholic, but unless I had that wine, I wouldn't have gone to bed. I wouldn't have slept. It was dreadful. Dreadful. And I was, the reason I'm ringing that girl, it's a great that you have this on your program.
Mm-hmm.
I was only reading there in the paper the other day about all the young people now, the drinking and the shots. The drinks now are crazy, you know, and they don't realise how quick that it can take you and take hold.
Mm-hmm.
And I remember a doctor in Connolly Hospital years ago, a functioning, and I said, no, there's no such a thing as a functioning alcoholic. He said, yes, there is. There is a functioning, so you can actually go on and pretend. You know, people, I'd be up out doing my work back home, but 7 o'clock, my door was shut and nobody came in my house after 7 o'clock. I sat there drinking.
And when you said, Vivian, if they hadn't gone or they didn't come in your door after that time, did people keep away or know they didn't want to be around you when you were drinking?
My family didn't say anything. You see, my husband was gone, so I only had my family with the grandchildren. And I'd often ask them to go and buy it from me.
Mm-hmm.
And it got to a stage where they wouldn't say no, but no one had actually said to me. Actually, one of my sons wrote me a letter one time. He wrote me a letter and told me he wouldn't come back. He wouldn't be seeing me again until I stopped drinking.
Really?
But sure, I just put that letter in the bin. My attitude was, and that was one of my sons, after losing my first son, you know, he sort of, yeah, I didn't care. I didn't care, John.
And Vivian,
all I wanted was my next bottle of wine.
And was that after losing your first son? Is that when this all came about?
Yes, I had lost my mother, my husband, and a granddaughter within the space of 11 months. And they were all like 2 months between. And that's when I started sort of getting a bit depressed and I was taken to bed. But then I said, no, I decided I don't know where it was, someone offered me wine, and I started drinking wine. And that took over then the bed, and that took over everything, and I was delighted with myself sitting there. Until I nearly died myself.
And that was your coping mechanism. But you mentioned a number of bereavements there in a very short space of time, and I'm sorry to hear about them all. It sounds really tough.
Within 11 months, now, I have to say, like, they were very quick because my mother died, my husband was dying with cancer, and then within 3 months, my granddaughter, my first one, their first grandbaby, Abigail, she died. So it was just bang, bang, bang. Now, I was feeling sorry for myself, so I was using that excuse too, you know. Mm-hmm. It was very hurtful, but it was my excuse then. And I think that's why, John, a lot of the family sort of allowed it to go on for a while. No one ever in my family said anything to me. It was the hospital, the doctor.
Well, your son wrote you that letter.
My son wrote me a letter. Yeah. Mm-hmm. He wrote me a letter telling me he wouldn't be coming near me again, because every time he came, I was drinking, or, you know, I wouldn't answer the door. He knew I wouldn't answer the door. I took the keys off them, so they wouldn't have a key. Or if he had a key, I would lock the door so they wouldn't get in. And I wouldn't answer the door.
You were pushing people away. You didn't want anybody calling you out on it, maybe.
I didn't want anybody. I just wanted my bottle of wine, John. My chair, my bottle of wine, and that was it. Or my two bottles of wine. Or my 2.5 bottles of wine.
And Vivian...
How many times I fell down the stairs, I couldn't tell you.
Really?
Oh, yeah. Fell down the stairs, up the stairs, and, like, I've had a heart failure. So it was the hospital just put it to me out straight, because I was going in and they were saying, are you drinking? I said, no. I'm only taking a couple of glasses. And I'm being honest, I think that particular son was with me one day. And I noticed the doctor, he texted, and the doctor looked at his phone. And that was the day the doctor told me. So I think my son told him, I've never known to this day, that what I was doing. And he said, right, it's going to be 3 months for me if you don't stop drinking. Now,
I'll give you 3 months if you don't stop drinking.
3 months to live if I don't stop drinking.
And that's what you meant about
actually his words were, you won't make 3 months. Yeah. Because, as I said, I had heart failure when I was doing this. I'd had cancer and chemotherapy, and I have heart failure. So I was drinking that on heart failure. A defibrillator actually implanted in my chest, and I was drinking, John.
Right.
And that bottle of wine meant more to me than my heart failure, my cancer, anything. That bottle of wine, two bottles of wine, sorry. Mm-hmm. They meant more to me than my health. And that's how drinking overtake a person. So I do agree, but I was just saying with that wine o'clock too. You know, that was a big joke. Oh, wine o'clock.
Vivian, you said you nearly died and you were told you'd be given 3 months. I mean, that's a wake-up call to anyone.
I wouldn't last 3 months.
Yeah, you wouldn't last 3 months.
That was exactly the word. I wouldn't last 3 months if I didn't stop.
And was it hard to stop then?
No, I just... I don't know, it was reality. I sat there, I looked. I thought of David, because David was gone. And I thought...
Your son, yeah.
Am I going to leave them now? And what are they going to think of me? Because, Lord rest him, the morning they took David away, his words were to the ambulance men, I'm an alcoholic. And that was at 11:15 on a Friday morning, and he was dead at 3:15 the same day. 3 hours he lasted, John. Mm-hmm. 3 hours.
You realised you wanted to live, Vivian.
So I said, I'm being selfish. It's all about yourself. Stop. And I just stopped. I didn't need to go anywhere now, in fairness. I didn't go to AA. I didn't go anywhere. I just stopped. And I haven't touched a drink since, or I'm not interested.
How long ago was that, Vivian?
Six years ago.
Well done.
6 years now. I'm sober 6 years.
How do you feel?
And the gas thing is, John, I was never drunk. I would fall, like, down the stairs and that, but I wouldn't be all falling all over the place. It was going up the stairs because of my health that I would, you know, go backwards. Mm-hmm. I feel absolutely fantastic. I can go in anywhere. I can sit. I've no problem with people sitting around me. Go to a room. I can go and go to a restaurant. You know, not a bother. It doesn't bother me. Mm-hmm. I could sit in a pub for a night. Wouldn't bother me. Mm-hmm. You know, it was brilliant. But it's thank God. Thank God I stopped, because I would have been, and again, what would have been, Mum. But alcoholism, she died. It's awful.
You had a lot more to live for, you decided, Vivian, and well done, and fair play to you for doing it.
I did have an awful lot, John. I have my family, and thankfully, lovely family, and I'm still here to talk about it.
Fair play to you, Vivian.
But if I had continued, I wouldn't be.
I'm so glad you are here, and thanks so much for talking to me on Liveline today.
0818 715 815. Thank you for the great show.
Thanks a lot. Thanks a lot, Vivian. I wish you good health and happiness always. rte.ie/helplines if you've been affected by those issues. And of course, we know the great work that AA Alcoholics Anonymous do as well for many people addicted to alcohol. We hear so many amazing stories, but it is important to hear them. And I want to hear yours about this and lots of other things besides. 51551.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Mary, hello.
Hi, John. How are you?
I'm very well. And you?
I'm not too bad now, really.
Good.
Not too bad.
You were at a concert. Thank you very much. You were at a concert. What happened?
I was, John. Last Friday, I was invited down to Waterford just to see the Whistling Donkeys. I hope I have that right.
The Whistling Donkeys.
Yeah, and they're an Irish traditional group. Excellent. And I said, well, why not?
Great.
I'm a widow and a granny, and I don't get out that often. So I said, I might as well.
Of course.
So, yeah, so I went over Friday, the 19th. I said, I'll go by train, because you all of us sort of arrive nice and relaxed by train. You know yourself. So. Mm-hmm. I loved the train, so I hopped on the train, but before I did, I paid my ticket, of course, as I would always do, and I decided I'd pay for the week, because it's only €11.
You were parking up the car at the train station.
Yeah, and I was getting the train down to Waterford mm-hmm. at whatever time, in the evening time, and I paid for a week's ticket, as I would, because I never know if it's, you know, if it's whether I'd stay a little bit longer or what. Whatever.
And you might need to leave the car there a bit longer in the car park. Yeah,
exactly. So everything, I like to have everything correct and right.
Yeah.
So I was happy enough. But you know, the look of God that I took the ticket out of the machine, John, because, you know, you could easily walk away. You think it's on the system anyway. I paid for it and docked it. But I had my ticket. So off I went. We had a great night down at the concert. And I decided I'd come back on the Monday, because I'm a new granny. And I said, I'll be needed at home. So I got on the train Monday, that'll be the 22nd, and arrived back in Fort Arlington Kildare, at, you know, in the evening time, 5 o'clock. Mm-hmm. And I said, perfect. I'm a carer. I said, I'm in time now to get to a client. So I walked up to the car, John, and I swear to God, I nearly had a heart attack. Maybe that's an over-exaggeration, but what I was looking at, I thought I was seeing things, was a clamp on my car, right?
The car was clamped.
Yeah. And this, you couldn't miss it, because you know the size of the clamp.
Yeah, the big yellow clamps, you can't miss them, yes.
Yeah, can't miss. And I tell you, the whole station didn't miss it, because I stood there in shock, really, and I said, what the hell? I did pay for it, didn't I? I started out myself, and I took my ticket out. I said, well, thank God. I'm right here and something's terribly wrong. So I was a little bit traumatized as to how I was going to sort this out. And then I was on my own, and the people off of the train, you know, there were lots of them every 15 minutes. They were all staring at me. Some were smiling, some was nodding the head as if to say, why didn't you? I was so embarrassed by it, that as well. So I rang the company, and the company, the name is APOCA, isn't that right? I have it right.
APCOA, yeah.
Yeah, APCOA.
People will see them from running car parks successfully and doing them well around the country, yeah.
Yeah, it's APCOA.
Yeah.
And so I would respect that. I'd have no problem paying if I hadn't a ticket paid, you know, fair enough. But I got on to the girl, got on to the company, and she couldn't understand it. And she said, well, there must be a mistake. And she said, can you email me on the ticket? I said, I'm actually a bit stressed. I said, I don't even know whether I have a reception here. I said, can you not look it up on the system? I said, it has to be on the system. I paid for it. So she looked it up in the system. No, she said, there is no car there with that registration. So I proceeded to email. I took a photograph of the ticket and I emailed it to her. And then she came back. And she said, yes. She said, you have paid for the ticket. And she said, I don't know. She said, where the mistake is here, because it's not coming up in the system. Well, I said, it's certainly not my end. And I said, and I have to get to a care, or I have to get to a client, I said, and I'm under pressure. I said, how long are you going to... But the bottom line, John, was I had to pay for it. She said, you have to pay, and you'll have to appeal it. I said, I'll have to appeal it.
So
something wrong here.
So, Mary, you've sent us your ticket too, and I can see very clearly you paid from the station in Kildare for parking right from Friday till the following Friday.
You are
standing there embarrassed. You just want to go home. You're emailing tickets now to try and prove it, and you're told you're right, but pay us the money.
And I was tired. Yeah, but pay up the money. So I said, how much is it? And she said, it's €120. I said, look, I need to get back. I said, I'll pay it. I said, how long is it going to be? Well, it could be 40 minutes. I said, Christ. And the evening was getting cold. And I was, like, really upset. I suffer from PTSD, and this wasn't... And I'm on heart medication. I said, I don't really need this. I was trying to keep calm.
Right.
And 2 hours later, John, I swear to God, this guy pulled in with an attitude. That's all I can say. Now, I know I was very
sorry, Mary. Did you pay the money?
Yeah.
€120.
Oh, yeah, I had to. Yeah, and I spoke to a machine. I tried to speak to somebody, but no, you put through to a machine and you just read out your card. So you've no comeback, really. I mean, you can argue with the machine, but that's not going to get you very far. But that, to me, wasn't the worst of it. It was the 2 hours wait, John. You know, when you're under pressure, and everything seemed to be wrong in this situation anyway. And the fact that I couldn't really talk to anybody, only this guy. And this guy got out, and I had the ticket in my hand, and I said to him, oh yeah, I went to take a photograph. I said, you know, this car is paid for. And I said, somebody's at fault here. I said, and I'm after having to endure the embarrassment of people for the last 2 hours coming and going. And I'm standing like a fool. But anyway, he wouldn't answer me. So then I got out my phone and I said, I have to take a photograph of this for evidence because I wasn't happy. And so he jumped up and he said, do not take a photograph of me. I didn't do this, and blah, 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 blah. And he said, I don't have to put up with it. And he said, he proceeded to put the lock back on. He said, I can just put the lock back on and walk away. Well, I said, OK, you do that. I said, because I'll be calling the guards anyway. But it was all too much, John. I just was getting more panicky. And I'm even getting panicky talking about it.
Take your time, relax. But it sounds very stressful, Mary, and I'm really sorry to hear it happen.
Well, it wasn't a night.
What happened in the end?
Well, in the end, John, I wasn't really getting anywhere with that guy, and I just sort of had back. He stood up and came into my face. I didn't like his attitude at all. And so when I mentioned the guards, he came back, and I tried to say to him, look, I said, you see where I'm coming from? Mm-hmm. I said, seriously? And then he said, I know nothing. He said, it wasn't me. And he walked
away. Okay. And he was so just there. He was sent to take the clamp off.
Yeah, he was part of the staff.
I'd imagine clampers get a lot of abuse from some people. You weren't abusing him, Mary, at all. Did he take the did he take the clamp off?
He took the clamp off and off he went. And off I went. It was 7:30 in the evening. It was getting cold and dark. And I mean, I should have been home at, 5:30? You know, but that's...
What time did you get home at? What time did you get home?
I got home at 7:45. And maybe someone else has that experience out there. But, you know, it doesn't seem right or fair that you can talk to no one. I did get talking to a lovely young girl, and she was so apologetic that she could do nothing. She was lovely. But after that, you were talking to a machine. You just had to pay. You had no argument. And thankfully, I had the 120 in my account. I'm a pensioner, and I'm a widower, John. And, I mean, they should really have a little bit of respect for the elderly. That's what I thought. And I wasn't... Okay. I had the proof in my hand, you know.
Yeah, well, and so I've seen your ticket. I've seen your ticket.
Yeah.
You paid your ticket for a week-long parking. You only stayed from... Needed the parking in the end from the Friday to the Monday. You came back... Found out you were clamped. You had to call to get the clamp taken off, but you had to pay €120. An email.
I did.
It was all on you.
An email. It was. It all came back on me, John.
And have you got the money back?
Not at all. I have to go now and possibly go to a solicitor, because I believe you're at nothing. I've talked to one friend that said, yeah, same experience, and you might as well be quizzing for it. To just ignore. So I don't know. Am I wasting my time going to a solicitor? I'd love to have some advice on it.
Well, I don't think you're going to forget about it easily, Mary, from what I can tell. But I know we have been in touch with APCO, with a company running the car park there, and they say in a statement to Liveline, they cannot comment on individual cases. However, APCOA would encourage anyone who believes that they have been clamped in error to pay the declamping fee, which is what you had to do, and then appeal as per the legislation. So you have to appeal this to the company. Do you know how to do that?
Yeah. I haven't a clue, John. Now,
is it online as well?
Yeah, it's online as well, because I emailed her and she did say she sent me a link. And, you know, I didn't even want to look at it after that. I said, what do? I just forget about it because it's too stressful. That I have to fill out forms and all that. For what? I did nothing wrong and they wouldn't listen to me. That was the thing. It was like there was no respect shown whatsoever that I had everything right.
€120 is a lot of money, particularly for car parking.
Well, it is, John. Yeah, I had a lovely weekend and that sort of spoiled the whole thing. You know, and I just wondered, is it a regular occurrence out there? And what is the protocol or procedure or... Have you a leg to stand on? That's what I'd love to know, really.
Well, the procedure, I'm told, is
you
need to appeal now.
Yeah.
Hopefully that'll work. Will it, Mary? You'll give it a try for €120
to put an end to the saga. Try, I suppose. Yeah, to get it out of my head. But I don't even know what that's all about. I think I'd walk away from it, John, to be honest with you, because I to go back and visit it, it just brings all my anxieties to the fore, you know. Well, and I don't know, is that good for me? Well, I think I'd fall for the 120 rather than... But maybe I'm wrong, maybe I will. And I cool down. You know yourself. And we have a new baby in the house and I'm trying to care for everybody.
Congratulations to you and to your family, because you mentioned you're a granny and a new granny to one child as well. And a great carer too as well, Mary, another great carer.
We all do our best out there. Yeah, we all do our best out there.
Well,
and that's it.
There is an appeals process. And you know what, Mary, €120, I mentioned the carers, and we hear from many great causes on the show as well. €120 could be better spent somewhere else. So you should chase it for yourself or whoever you want,
John,
to have it. But it's too much to be paying for that.
When you say that, you're right, actually. Mm-hmm. It'd be wrong of me to walk away from it, because maybe they'll change their policies, because it's happened too often.
Well,
I'm sure I'm not the only one out there.
They say you can appeal. I wish you well with it, Mary. Maybe let us know how you get on. And thanks very much for talking to us on Liveline today. And enjoy that new grandchild of yours as well. 51551 at liveline@rte.ie if you want to get in touch with us if these or other issues are affecting you. And it's 0818 715 815 to give us a call. Rosanna, good afternoon.
Hey, how are you?
I'm very well, Rosanna. I was asking people yesterday, were they Cian Ducrow fans? Do you like his music?
I don't know who he is, I'm embarrassed to say.
Well, don't worry.
I was going to lie and say I love his music, but I thought better not do that.
You should have a listen, because he's definitely one to watch and one on the rise. A very popular Irish singer, a songwriter, and doing very well as well. But what we were interested in was his comments about digital detox, about switching off the social media. And I'm wondering, Rosanna, is that something you've ever managed to do?
Yeah, I've built an entire business on it. I think it's incredibly important. I run a company called Samsu, and we build and design off-grid cabins in nature for people to do digital detoxes. And we've seen a huge surge in demand for it. So I think, yeah, I think more and more people are trying to do them, and I do them regularly.
Take me back a bit, Rosanna. How much were you on your social media? How much screen time you were spending on your phone? Or how did it all start for you?
Yeah, I am a self-confessed social media addict, I would say, as are, I think, most people of my age and the generation slightly younger. I'm a millennial. I was working for a tech company before starting Samsu, which was obviously very heavily screen-based. And I was working for a company that was US-based. So I was working London time, full 8-hour day for London. And then American team would come on at 4 p.m. my time, and I'd effectively work a second day. And then combine that with waking up first thing in the morning, scrolling, checking emails, and then as I fall asleep at night, checking Slack, checking emails, checking TikTok, checking Instagram. So the screen time was high, and it was...
Do you know how much, Rosanna? Negatively. Were you ever off the phone or offline, Rosanna? Could you put a number on how long you were online in a daytime?
Oh, 14, 15, 16 hours a day.
Really?
Yeah, really bad. Now, you're including Spotify and Google Maps, but looking at a screen, yeah, 14, 15 hours a day.
And all the social media and all the work that you mentioned as well.
Picking up my phone, I remember looking at a stat on my phone saying that I'd picked up my phone 135 times that day to check, you know, a notification or some sort of social media notification. So it was bad.
Uh-huh. Or were you enjoying it? Did it feel bad, Rosanna, that there was anything wrong with it?
It felt bad. It felt bad, but it felt addictive. You know, you feel like you need to be online in case you're missing out, and you feel a need to keep up with what your friends are doing and what your peers are doing. And also you feel the need to reply to emails instantly, reply to Slack messages instantly in case for work they might think that you're, you know, skiving off or anything like that. So there's definitely a pressure, yeah, to be online and to be answerable at all hours of the day.
So there's the pressure from work, and then there's FOMO, or fear of missing out. Is that it? Just that you want to know what everyone else is doing?
Yeah, and also the very nature of the apps themselves, that you are addicted, you want to go on, you feel this urge for that dopamine hit that the algorithms give you every time you press refresh. You know, whether it's on an app that's not bad for you, like the likes of Vinted or Spotify, or whether it's something that we know is much more harmful, like Instagram or TikTok, the urge is always there. So yeah, whether it's work, FOMO, or just the general addiction, all three are pulling you towards being on your phone.
And you mentioned there a couple of things, the dopamine hit of that the algorithm gives you. What is that? It made you feel good to see lots of new things or things that you were interested in, or what?
Yeah, these companies, I used to work for Facebook as my first job out of college, ironically. And these companies have hired psychologists. They know exactly what they're doing. They use psychology strategies. Like the news feed and like the infinite scroll that was invented by one of the tech companies. And they use these strategies to harness our attention and to keep us coming back. If you think about a slot machine and why someone feels the need to put that 5-cent coin in over and over again and pull that lever for the little hit and the wonder if this time they're going to hit the jackpot. That's what it feels like every time you refresh on Instagram and TikTok and scroll the For You page. There was one time when TikTok launched, and it felt like my algorithm sort of understood my likes and dislikes for the first time. I was scrolling TikTok for 3 hours, and it was only that someone sent me a WhatsApp message that I actually realized that I, how long I'd been scrolling for. And I remember sending them a message saying, thank you so much for texting me. I don't know how much longer I would have lay there and scrolled had you not interrupted my doom scrolling session.
So thanks for shaking me out of it.
Yeah, like they're just sending you a message and to say hello.
And I'm sure our listeners will relate to this. 51551 if you want to get in touch. I had a silly conversation with my wife recently where I said, why do I keep getting so many videos of funny wedding speeches or people falling over at weddings? And I think it's just because I was looking at pictures of a friend's wedding recently. I finally worked it out. But that's what you're on about.
100%, yeah. And the algorithms are so smart now. And, in a way, sometimes it's good. If you're looking up DIY and you want to know how to hang a shelf, you're probably going to see more DIY videos. Mm-hmm. So that's okay. That's not so harmful. But if you're a young person and you're 15 or 16 and you're trying to figure out who you are and you're comparing yourself to others and you're looking up videos to do with that and you're served more and more videos like that, it's very harmful. It can negatively impact your mental health big time.
You felt bad as well, is what you said. So how did you first try a digital detox yourself?
It was sort of an accident. I was on a trip to Copenhagen with my husband, and we ended up on this small island called Samsø. And this island it's magical. Denmark, back in the 90s, being Denmark and being ahead of the curve, they were already thinking about how they were going to get to net zero carbon emissions. And Denmark is made up of a series of islands. And they held this competition, and the winning island would get to be Denmark's test pot for all of their strategies. So say they were trialing wind energy, they'd trial it on this island. If it worked, they'd scale it up nationally. So anyway, right. Samsø won that competition. Okay. So this island, it's like stepping back in time, but also stepping into the future at the same time. The island only has 3,000 people on it, primarily agricultural land. But yet it's covered in wind turbines. Everyone's driving little electric cars. All the houses are powered by heat pumps and wood pellet stoves. And it's amazing. But what struck us when we arrived was this pace of life and how slow everyone was that was living there. You know, there's no Amazon supermarkets where you scan your phone and shop in mm-hmm. silence with no human beings around you. It was a beautiful place. But most importantly, the phone signal was really bad. And because we booked the trip last minute, we ended up glamping in this yurt in a field. And I basically had no phone signal for 3 days. And at the time, my mental health was on the floor. I was doing all sorts of different types of therapy. I was exercising. I was doing all the good stuff. But I was having regular panic attacks. I threw up on my way to work. My mental health was very, very bad.
Wow.
From all of this social media use and being on my screen and being addicted to work and all that.
So you're in a yurt.
Anyway,
you're on an island.
I'm in a yurt.
There's no phone signal.
There's no phone signal. And we spent 3 days there. And on returning on that ferry back to the mainland of Denmark, I felt like myself again for the first time in probably 5 years. I could not get over how good that island made me feel. So good that I decided to quit my job in tech. I moved back to Ireland and I started a company called Samsø after that island, to create spaces for other people to be able to do the same. So it was a very, very profound experience. So it was an accidental digital detox. Now I'm creating intentional ones for other people.
But you're still online for work, I'm thinking, here, Rosanna.
Yeah.
But you know how to limit it or to put it away for a while or to maybe take days off, or do you leave a phone outside the bedroom, things like that?
Funny enough, I was having this conversation with someone the other day, and they were saying that they view social media addiction like smoking or alcohol. And so to them, you need 30 days abstinence to prove that you're no longer an addict. And actually, I don't think that that's the right way to approach social media or phone use in general, because we need our phones for every day. I need social media to market Samsø. So what we recommend and what I do is I block social media for a certain number of hours each day. So I use an app called Opal. And so I block all apps with an algorithm from 8 p.m. okay. at night until 12 noon the following day. It's a paid, you can get a free version, okay. but the paid version allows you to get
a number. And there are lots of solutions actually in your hand on that phone that you can use to control it a bit. Rosanna, thanks so much for telling us your story and giving us some ideas on it as well. We don't all have to go to an island, to a yurt to get off the phone, but maybe try and put it away for a while if you can. Kian Ducrow was saying he was leaving it outside the bedroom, and regardless of whether people could contact him or not, it made him feel better for doing it. He was calmer as a result. What about you? Have you tips or suggestions for us? 51551, please.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
Philip Nolan, how are you?
I'm very well, John. How are you?
I'm good. Thanks very much for talking to us on Liveline today. Philip was no stranger to lots of radio listeners who've heard him on the airwaves over the years. He writes in the Daily Mail as well for many years. And Philip, I'm thinking anyone else who's scrolling, because we were talking about that a moment ago, will have followed your culinary delights throughout COVID online. You put up some great pictures of some great recipes. And more recently, your health story as well. What happened in April?
Well, in April, I was sent to Rome to cover the funeral of Pope Francis, which was on the Saturday, if you remember.
I do, I was so there.
I flew over on, indeed, yes. And I flew over on the Thursday, and then on the Friday morning, I was on the way down to St. Peter's Square to pick up my accreditation. I felt very, very strange, and I went into a cafe and ordered a coffee and a croissant and thought, this will sort me out. But actually, even before they arrived at the table, I realised I was in trouble. And I said to the guy behind the counter, look, I actually need a doctor. And he twigged us very quickly, I have to say. And he massaged my shoulders and said, stay awake, don't go asleep. And an ambulance arrived. And within minutes, I literally was having an operation for a stroke. They put a stent in. They got rid of the blood clot. I spent 5 days in the high dependency unit. And then I spent 2 weeks there in hospital. Then I flew home, thanks to the office and the insurance I had, thankfully. And I was 10 days at Wexford General and then 3.5 months in St. John's and then at Scorty.
Mm-hmm. Philip, it's great to hear you sounding so well, but you've been through so much. To realise you were having a stroke and to be in surgery in Rome within a number of hours from just heading off to the Pope's funeral, you must have been in awful shock.
Well, to be honest with you, I hadn't got time to be in shock, to be honest, John. I'm a very practical individual in that respect. I think it probably comes from my mother, who had a mastectomy when she was 49 and just dealt with it. And I think I just dealt with it. It's that simple. I realised I was quite sick. There were certain habits I gave up, for sure. I was probably hypertensive from the start. And so I just dealt with it all. And I have led a very kind of clean lifestyle ever since.
Are you there, Philip?
Oh, yes, I can hear you. Can you hear me?
Yeah, I can. We'll keep on talking, because, Philip, I'm wondering, how did you feel specifically? Because we hear the ads on the radio and we know the importance of spotting a stroke quickly and the signs FAST, F-A-S-T, that acronym, face, arm, speech, time. Was there anything obvious there for you? Because you said the man in the cafe in Rome spotted something.
I'd say he spotted the fact my mouth had drooped. Because all of those symptoms don't necessarily happen at once. For me personally, it was a metallic taste to my mouth, which is quite weird when you think about it.
Mm-hmm.
I felt it twice before, actually, in December. And I don't know if it was related or not, but certainly that was something that hadn't happened before December of last year, and it happened again just before the stroke.
Right. And how has the stroke impacted on your life then, Philip?
Well, the funny thing about stroke, John, is it affects people in different ways. Some people have aphasia, so they can't speak properly, and other people have problems with cognition. I had none of those problems insofar as, yes, I couldn't pronounce my R's, for instance, so that was because my mouth drooped and wasn't strong enough to do that. It's back now to an extent, but I couldn't move. Basically, I couldn't walk. And the doctor, when I arrived at Wexford, was fairly convinced they would never use my right arm again. So I was actually very lucky that I do have the right arm. I don't have the hand 100% yet by any stretch of the imagination, but it will get there, hopefully. I mean, it's early days yet. And, you know, it can take a year, 2 years or more even for a stroke to fully correct itself. So, yes, I look forward to a better recuperation. Well, I've been home a month now. I can dress, I can shower. I can't really shave. I haven't got the strength to do that. There are lots of things I can't do. I can't, you know, I don't like chopping vegetables. I can do it, but I don't like doing it because there's no power. But otherwise, I'm okay.
And could you use your were you right-handed or left-handed? Does that matter now?
No, well, this is the unfortunate part. It actually happened on my dominant side, which is my right-hand side. I know it sounds terrible, but if it had happened the other way around, it would have been better, to be honest. Like, I do wear a stint on my right leg. That is only to stop me from actually going over on my foot, because the tendency in my bare foot is to go over on one side, and tripping would be a hazard because of that. But, you know, I'm getting better as the days go on.
Good.
My neighbours have been great. My family have been great. My friends have been great. And, you know, there's plenty to be positive about.
And take it from a kithog here, Philip. You'll be okay with your left hand as well. Or it's not affecting your writing, I'm seeing. Maybe things you said in your article a little slower at typing, but you're still churning out the work.
Yeah, I mean, things are definitely slower. Again, the office have been fantastic. I'm back on a phased basis, so I don't have to do everything straight away. And if I, you know, if I get tired, I just ring up and say, look, you know something, I'll do it next week. Let's leave it for this. But I don't think I'll have to be honest with you. It just, like I say, it takes an awful lot longer than it used to. But hopefully I'll get better.
Philip, two things struck me in particular about your article, and it's the time is of the essence here, as we know. You got to hospital quickly and were operated on to remove a clot very quickly as well. And remarkably, you say you feel lucky at this stage, even though you had a stroke in Rome 6 months ago.
I do feel lucky because, you know, my cognition could have been affected, and that would have been a serious problem for a journalist, obviously. Mm-hmm. And my speech could have been affected permanently. I wouldn't have known. I don't know if it could have been or not, but it certainly wasn't, thankfully, because I was there so quickly. But I think the one thing that really has made me feel lucky is that friends, the office, family, everybody has really come up trumps, you know. I've been so lucky with who I know and what they've given me in terms of presents, and total strangers who sent cards and vase bouquets and all sorts of things, presents, gifts. It's really lovely to have seen the good side of people at a time when we're told people are bad sometimes, to be honest, you know.
You're seeing the good in things, Philip. And well done for a great positive outlook and so far a great recovery that we wish you all the very best with. Good health to you, Philip Nolan. 51551 for your texts.
Liveline on RTE Radio 1. 0818 715 815.
We were talking on the programme this week and yesterday in particular about becoming a parent later in life. Alan, good afternoon.
Good afternoon, John.
Alan, your dad was an older parent. Tell me a little bit more about your situation.
Yes, my late dad got married late in life. He got married in his 40s and married a much younger woman, which was my mum, and she was only 23. And he had me in his 50s, and then he went on to have my sister, and he was 64.
Right. Fair play to him.
It did indeed, yeah. And like for an older dad, he was a very much hands-on dad. He was a great dad.
He's a great dad indeed. Well, it's nice to remember, I suppose, how that was when you were a child, is what I'm wondering. Did he seem like an older dad, or was there anything different about him?
No, not to us. He was dad. But as we got older, he told us wonderful stories. As like my dad was born the 23rd of April 1916, when they were, you know yourself, they were making bits of the GPO at the time.
Right.
And he grew up during World War II, and he told us wonderful stories as a young man, as it was then. It was great, and he was telling me about, you know, ration books and, you know, my dad rode a bicycle all his life and how hard it was to get a tyre for a bicycle, you know.
Mm-hmm. And where did he cycle to?
He cycled to the town of Moat in Westmead every single day of his life.
For work or what?
No, for leisure. When he was retired, he worked with CIE all his life. And for leisure, he cycled into Moat every day, and he loved to back an old horse, and he would back a horse just for a hobby every single day, and he was very outgoing, and he would talk to the locals along the way.
I think he'd earn that pleasure if he'd cycled that far every day. Fair play to him.
Every single day, yes. my own doctor was my late father's doctor, and he said to me, "Oh God," he said, "your dad was a model patient." He said he'd done everything right. He cycled every day, which now people cycle for pleasure. And my late dad, he also was an avid card player. He played Progressive 25, and he used to go at least four nights a week. And at that, of course, he would play partners, and he would be keeping his partner's score in his head and his own score as well. So, like, as my own doctor said, he'd done everything right and natural.
Uh-huh. And how long did he keep cycling?
He was cycling up until he's 90. He was 90 years of age.
Wow, fair play to him. Alan, you could learn a thing or two there, I'd say. There was lots to learn from your dad. Stay with me if you can. Maura, good afternoon to you.
Good afternoon, Richard.
John here.
Well, you beat that. My dad was born in 1895.
Very good. And tell me, how old was he when you were born?
On hold.
Oh, well, we've lost Maura on the line there. We'll find out about her dad in just a moment. But she's put us on hold for a moment. Alan, I'm wondering if your dad was retired, as you said. Did it mean maybe you got to see more of him or yourself and your sister than other children would as you were growing up or what?
We did indeed. Yes, we did. As I said, when I was a youngster, I remember Dad working with CIE and his blue overalls, you know. But yeah, we did. We got to see a lot of him, and Dad taught me how to fish and taught me a lot of life skills, you know.
They sound like lovely memories. Have they affected the way I suppose you live your life now?
I do indeed. Yes, but I was smiling to myself yesterday as I was listening to your show about older dads, you know.
And can you cycle as well as them? That's what I was wondering.
I try. Hopefully, I have my dad's genes now. Hopefully, I have.
I hope you do. I hope you keep going as long as he did. Maura, tell me about your dad.
Well, my dad was from Belfast, and he was born in 1895. Think about that.
Wow.
And my mother was from Kerry, here from Killorglin, and she was born in 1910. There was 15 years between them. They met late in life. She'd have been in her late 30s, and he would have been in his late 40s. He was a bank manager in Kerry Kinshannon, County Leitrim, and that's where they met. And
very good. How old was he when you were born?
He was 43, 58.
58
and
when he became
43.
A dad. Right.
Yes. And they had plenty of energy, I can assure you.
Were you
they
conscious of
on
them?
A second career at that stage.
Very good. Were you conscious of your dad being an older dad? Or was there anything different about him to you?
I was conscious that he was older, yes. See, he had white hair, but then he had white hair when he was in his 30s. So it didn't seem that extreme, you know. And when I went away to boarding school, there was he used to be mistaken for my granddad sometimes coming to collect me. I didn't take any notice because there was another school friend and her dad had married late in life as well. And there was 25 years of a distance between her father and mother. It was quite common back in the day because, you know, particularly with farmers, because they had to get the farm in their own name and the sisters had to be married off, you know.
Right.
To get the house empty. I guess.
Before they could move someone in. I see your point. You didn't mind people mistaking him for your granddad, or did he, I wonder?
Not a bit. He was full of energy. He was extremely loving. He was unmentionably generous. And, you know, it was a lovely home to be brought up in.
Maura, he sounds like a great dad.
Decent people, yes, they were. We were very fortunate.
Uh-huh. Yeah. Lovely memories. So when you hear of people thinking of having children later in life, we were talking about some people not feeling ready to do it till they were older. There can be positives, you say.
Oh, there are positives. But they are getting married later or settling down later now because they can't afford it when they're younger.
Okay.
Housing isn't available.
We might have more older dads too. So I hope they're as good as yours, Maura, and as good as yours, Alan.